Welcome to the Law Shit You Should Know podcast. We're here to talk a little bit about the law
and a whole lot about nothing. Every week, we have a new guest to discuss current events, legal drama, and dive even deeper into
the Law Shit You Should Know.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Law Shit You Should Know with Alina Santana.
And Leslie Marenko.
And today we have the amazing Barry Wax with us. Hi, Barry.
Hi, I'm amazing.
You are great. Amazing.
Can you call my wife and tell her that?
We'll call her in the next couple minutes.
Either amazing or infamous, one of the two.
Infamous.
You're on this show. Yeah. We always say they're amazing or infamous.
That's good. I like that, Leslie. That works for me.
And one day we'll be famous podcasters, not just infamous lawyers, okay? Yeah, we'll be famous podcasters.
And then you'll actually have sponsors.
Yes. I need Red Bull, sugar-free Red Bull to sponsor us.
I think it's a great idea.
She's already working on it. We got Disney up here. We got Starbucks. Yeah, yeah. I have some boba tea going on.
I'm
going
to hit up the LexisNexis guy next.
Sometimes we have Rockstar. We got stuff going on. Yes. Oh, anyways, right. Barry, tell everyone who you are and what you do. Please.
Well, I'm Barry Wax, and I am a criminal defense attorney. I've been practicing law for 39 or so years right now. I was born and raised in Miami Beach. I'm a proud South Florida native.
You know, very rare these days.
Well, I don't think it's as rare as people think, and they always say that to me. You know, I was back when I was born, which was, 1958.
Well, that was more common at that time.
It was, at that time, everybody was a transplant, you know, but now with the explosion of Miami, I mean, my mother-in-law is a native. My wife is a native. My kids were all born here, I just love the fact that I'm from Miami Beach because it used to be such a wonderful place to live and grow up, and it still is. You know, I still live in the north part of Miami Beach and in Bell Harbor, and then I have, I probably shouldn't have said that. Now people know where to find me.
They're going to seek you out. No,
anyway.
As long as we don't give them an address, I think you're solid.
You know, so... But I did. I did go to college at Florida State University. I was a communications major with
Seminole.
An emphasis in film. Yeah, but my daughter's a Gator. I have a son who's going to UCF this fall. My other son went to FSU. My wife went to FIU.
So you're
We're
all
covering
over.
The state.
Yeah, I was about to say all over Florida.
Yeah. But I was a film major. I worked in the film industry.
I didn't know that. Look at that. I'm already learning things.
Isn't that interesting? I worked in the film industry. Starting in probably 1979, I had an internship and I worked in film until I started law school.
What kind of film should I ask?
Maybe no, I mean, it's back in the late 70s.
I don't know, it was the 70s.
Good point. You know, and Miami.
Did you have a mustache back then?
I did, yes. Yes, I did. I grew a mustache. I had my mustache for like 13 years.
Mm.
And I actually, when I shaved it, people said to me, why did you shave your mustache? I go, well, it was coming up on its bar mitzvah, and I didn't want to pay for the party.
Love that.
Yeah, it worked. But anyway, so no, I was working in film actually pre-Miami Vice.
Okay.
I worked for Universal Studios. I worked for ABC. We shot a lot of commercials in South Florida then. All the New York ad agencies would come down here in the winter so they could film their spring campaigns. And then, it was back then Florida was really encouraging film production.
Yeah.
And so I had been working on sets for a few years and I really enjoyed it, but I came to the realization that my place was in the boardroom, the executive producing side, raising money, financing films, and really behind the scenes. So I said, well, I was an art student, basically. So I went back to law school to learn everything that I didn't know.
Did you know you wanted to go to law school at some point?
No, that was kind of weird, too. You know, I never really thought about going to law school. My sister was a court reporter here in Miami, and she was married to a family lawyer who was also a trial lawyer. And they both sort of started encouraging me to go to law school. And
got the personality for it, Barry.
Yeah. It was very strange, and I was working on a commercial for Tide detergent, and the ad agency was one of the big ad agencies out in New York City, and the director was a guy named Bill Fertel, one of the big commercial directors. I mean, commercial directors, you know, they're like film directors. You just don't know who they are, but in the industry, there's big names, and he was a big name, and so they were arguing on the set about a shot where they were pouring the crystals into the hand of the hand model. And, you know, you have to make sure that the hand, the thumb, is away from the camera or you don't see the crystals.
Okay.
And the executive for the ad agency was arguing with Bill about the thumb and where it should be, and she was insisting the thumb be facing the camera, and he was trying to persuade her that we can't do that, that shot won't work. And so there was a break, and I happened to catch him, and I said, hey, Bill, can I ask you a question? And he said, sure, Barry, what is it? I said, you know, I have an opportunity to go to law school. You have any thoughts on that? He's like, yeah, go. And, you know.
But you don't think this was a response to a very petty argument about a hand model?
No.
Like, yeah, dude, do anything but fucking argue about this hand.
Maybe, you know, at the end of the day, maybe I wanted him to tell me to go. Maybe I needed that push. And so I went. I went to UM. And in my second year of law school, I was working as the business agent for one of the film labor unions, for the union that represents all the technicians on the set, mm-hmm. the electricians, the scenic design, the, you know, the grips, the gaffers, the best boys, and their union. And I was, you know, helping them out. And I decided I would go into the trial competition at UM.
Okay.
The mock trial competition. And I won. And nice. I really liked it. I enjoyed trying cases. And Terry
Anderson.
And
so you were like, forget entertainment law or...
Yeah, I never had a desire to do that. But Terry Anderson, who was my the professor who handled the trial team, said, Barry, go to the public defender's office and they'll let you try real cases. You know, and I said, great. So I became an intern my third year of law school at the public defender's office.
Nice.
And I tried 6 felony trials and I won them all. And they offered me a job.
Very nice.
And, you know, it's like Yogi Berra says, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. And I became a criminal defense lawyer.
I
am 39 years later.
Still and doing criminal defense?
I love criminal defense. I enjoy it so much. You know, it's funny. And not to knock civil lawyers.
Yeah.
But it's sort of an oxymoron. If you deal with civil lawyers, you know, they're really harsh. And you guys are civil lawyers. You know. You know, Ellie, you're sort of quasi.
I'm quasi. I fit in neither
quasi,
bucket.
Right. And Leslie, yes. You're a civil attorney. And, you know, sometimes they can be less than civil.
For sure. Yes. For
and,
sure.
And when you deal in criminal defense, most of the time, people treat each other.
The criminal bar is
it's
is,
different.
Yes, it's different.
But
different.
The immigration bar is very, there's a lot of collegiality because it's kind of the us against the man kind of feeling that
yeah.
we have going on. It's
right.
the same in our world as well. I'd
yeah,
say.
No question.
Yeah,
no
yeah,
question.
Very similar.
Not in
very
my
similar.
World, though.
No.
We're awful people. We're awful
well, it's
people.
Funny. So,
everybody.
So I was representing a defendant in a murder case, and he was accused of murdering his fiance by poisoning her, and they had she had a will, and he was left everything.
Yeah,
and there was a life
pretty rare for a man,
policy.
Though. No, isn't that usually the way women
you know,
kill? Yeah, I've learned this from watching bad crime dramas.
Bad Law and Order episode.
Poisoning is the way women kill people.
Oh,
because you know it's
this
not.
Is so not manly
healthy.
Enough.
No.
This is not manly enough.
No, so.
Anyways,
so,
I'm sorry. I'm
no,
sorry. Go
don't
on.
Be sorry. It's fine. You know, I can digress on that one and tell you that I was representing a guy years ago who was accused of murdering someone and stabbing him with a knife. And I went to see him in the jail, and I said, okay, you know, let's talk about your case. And he goes, Mr. Wax, he goes, I couldn't possibly have committed this murder. And I said, well, why? Why couldn't you have committed this murder? He goes, because it's a stabbing. I don't stab people. He goes, you got to get up on top of them and push the knife in and the blood squirts out and gets all over.
He knew a little too much about
it's,
no, the mechanisms.
It's
yeah.
messy.
Isn't
it's
he's
messy.
Like, I wouldn't do that again.
No, he goes, this is messy. He goes, now I'll shoot somebody, but I won't stab them.
Exhibit
like,
A, Your Honor.
Like,
my client
okay.
is innocent.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man,
so
I love
it was
that.
Crazy, but I know that there was something that got me off on this tangent, whatever I was
sorry,
talking about.
Sorry, sorry.
Oh, it's okay. I think I was talking about another murder. Oh, yeah. So
poisoning.
I was, right, it was a poisoning, and they were trying to keep the fiance,
sure.
the survivor, the,
yeah.
from getting the proceeds of his now
sure.
deceased fiance's estate.
Yeah.
And so a family member had sued to stop
absolutely.
That from happening. And so I had to go to litigation court for probate, what you
oh,
two
okay.
Leslie. And we were in front of the judge, and my dear friend Bruce Katzen was
yes.
across the table from me representing the family of
oh,
the decedent.
How fun!
And yes, and it was. And Bruce, for all of his kindness and professionalism.
Oh, but no.
Is very aggressive in court.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, he's kind of like me when I'm cross-examining a snitch. You know, there's no genteel approach.
Snitches get stitches.
Like that. And in any event, you know, I'm like, you know, this is just a different world to me. Yeah. Being there. But I do a lot of stuff in civil court, domestic violence hearings, and I associate with family lawyers on those cases, and, you know, a lot of white-collar crime that I do involves civil issues, and sometimes there's civil litigation, and we all have to go on and collaborate to make sure that...
Yeah, and some administrative stuff, too, right? We were talking before you got on, some sort of, you know, license, people who do things that get them in trouble, professionals,
right?
Realtors.
Wait. So, the poisoning... Did you?
Yeah. Do you want instructions? So, Leslie, do you want instructions?
No. I'm the gun type too. Yeah. I mean, you know, if I'm going to go down like this, I'm not going to poison you.
Because
like,
I want you to know. I just want to let you know that's not privilege. That's crime fraud exception. If I were to do something that, you know, it would all come out
at some point.
No, that case ended rather tragically, unfortunately. And, it was in the news, and my client decided he had a better place in the universe to be than here, and decided to hasten his own demise.
Sorry to hear that.
That was the end of that case, but I hate
that. So
that
was the end of the probate fight,
apparently. That came as quite a surprise. It really did.
Yeah, it really did.
But, hey, you know, that's part of what we do for a living,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, human nature is very complicated.
It is.
And so, yeah. So.
And you deal with very emotionally charged matters, regardless of innocent or guilty. It's still an emotionally charged situation.
Yeah, and I think that too many attorneys lose sight of that, whether it's criminal or civil. You know, when people come to see a lawyer, a lot of times they've never done that before.
Yeah.
And whether it's civil or criminal. And lawyers don't, I think a lot of lawyers take that for granted. That they say, well, you know, I've got a job to do. Okay, let me get your information. And okay, why are you here? Tell me about what you need. And they just jump right into it. And I feel like that's not good. Because it's like when you go to the doctor. So you got a pain in your side. And you think the worst. Oh, my God, I'm dying. Oh, my God. You know, what is wrong with
me? Dr. Google says, I have liver cancer and I got 6 months to live.
And then you go, you go on WebMD and Dr. Google and all that.
Yes.
And all of a sudden you just can't sleep. And it's like, oh, Jesus. And so in any event.
The public perception of what you do in this area of law is more tainted than any other area of law. Right. Even though
absolutely,
I'm sure there are. I've never seen this new show or it's old show that's now on Netflix that everybody tells me I need to go see. That's a civil whatever. So I guess there are a lot
of civil. What show? I don't even know what you're talking about.
I don't either. Everybody keeps telling me, oh, you've got to watch this civil. It's a civil show.
OK.
But I feel like more than ever, the Law and Orders and the Blue Bloods and the whatever are so much more fascinating than any of these civil lawyer shows ever be. Oh, there it is.
Suits.
Everybody says suits. So, you know, there is a lot of people that will think, oh, look, civil litigation is so exciting. It's fucking
suits
not.
Is not real life either,
but,
though.
You do definitely has the biggest, I think, has a lot more in your world. Everybody thinks they know what's going on in your world, and it's also exciting, and it's also fascinating. And
no, they don't know.
You go to trial in a week. And
right.
Oh, yeah. On every TV show, and go to trial. You still have the bruises on the face. Like, what are those bruises from a week ago?
Do you remember Boston Legal with William Shatner?
Yes.
And
yes.
Who was it? James Spader. Great actors. And, you know, I remember watching an episode of that. And I don't watch law shows because I would pull out what hair I have left watching them. But I remember watching
that
show.
It made me very upset, and I'm not even a criminal defense attorney.
And I get
so angry. My husband and I sit there screaming objections at the TV. It's terrible. It's terrible.
Because my wife watches every law show.
Yes, that's me.
And I'll come in the bedroom, and I will watch a show that she's watching, and there will be a trial on, and I'll just go, no. No, that's not happening.
We watch Law and Order, and Jonathan and I just sit there like, lawyer, lawyer, lawyer.
I'm pro proud to say I have never watched a single episode of Law and Order. But I will tell you, so, you know, when
they always confess at the end, let me cut to the chase.
Always, yeah, always. You know, it's just, you know what's going to happen. It's you know, but no. I love the formula. I mostly like rom-coms. I like that formula. Mm. You know,
the rom-coms.
Oh, I'm a big rom-com
guy. You heard it here
guy.
First.
Yeah. Because it's light, it's nice. You know, there's a meet cute. There's a falling in love. There's a conflict. There's
a
resolution.
I love it.
And then there's you know, then they get back together.
Yeah. Oh, and then they get back together.
Yeah, always. Except in the 1970s. When they made those movies and they didn't get back together.
Yeah, they ended sad.
Yeah, they ended sad.
Yeah.
But that was
or someone
70s.
Died.
But that was the 70s?
Yeah, 70s film, you know.
But we're back to like,
I was a film student.
We're back to like the Sandra Bullock and Julia Roberts ones now.
Right.
We're good. We're good.
But so anyway, so you know, it's like when you see a lawyer, it's like when you go to the doctor and the doctor sort of has to examine you and diagnose you and decide how to treat you. And surgery's like a last resort. Unless you go to a back doctor, they like to cut.
They love
surgery. Did you ever notice that?
They love surgery.
And of course, they don't show the part about the insurance company not paying for
correct.
It.
Correct.
But, you know, that's for the insurance defense companies.
Yeah.
You know, those guys are insurance defense lawyers. Are you listening? That really sucks. Okay. So, you know, so what I do when I meet with someone is I try to connect with them, you know, and I talk to them about who they are. You know, the first question I ask people is I go, tell me about yourself. You know, where were you born? Where'd you go to school? Are you single or married? Do you have kids? What are your interests? Do you like to read? Do you play golf or sail? Or, you know, what do you do with yourself? Who are you? And people like talking about themselves. That's easy. But what they don't realize is happening. Oh, God, now they're going to know what I'm doing.
Now you're giving away the secret here,
Mary. I'm giving
away
the secret. I'm connecting with them, and I'm putting them at ease so that when I do talk with them, they open up to me.
Have you ever done any sales training?
Oh, yeah. I've been to sales seminars as a lawyer.
Are you a Sandler trained?
No, I'm not a Sandler trained guy, but I will tell you that I had a coach several years back.
Yeah.
And... you know, one of the things the coach was talking about how to run your law firm and do all that, but there were certain people who he was introducing people to, and at the end of the day, I've always told this. I tell this to lawyers: we're all salesmen.
Yeah.
Whether we
it's
like
not just
or
lawyers,
I'm sorry,
everybody.
I was so politically incorrect.
Why?
God, what is wrong with me?
Oh, salespeople. It's fine.
Oh, wow,
this is not a PC podcast.
Fucking Leslie, how did you let me get away with
oh,
that?
Oh, she's the least PC on the podcast,
but
even
I
would correct
say that
you.
To you. That's why I had to say that.
I'm usually the one.
Yeah, so anyway, so...
I didn't even realize for a second what he meant.
But it's true. You know, we sell everyone.
People.
I mean, you have to sell your client to hire you, because, you know, you've got competition. You have to sell opposing counsel.
Sure.
You have to sell witnesses, jurors.
Whether you know it or not, that's what we do. We're in sales.
Right. So, you know, so at the end of the day, I said, hey, I think I need to go to a sales seminar. So I did. And it was life-changing. And I still read. I just got done reading a book on sales called Streetwise to Saleswise. It was written by two authors, Jeff West and Bob Berg. Now, Bob Berg is
amazing. The master of networking, yeah.
He's amazing. And for lawyers out there, if you want to learn how to network, read anything
Endless
by
Referrals.
Bob Berg. Endless Referrals is the Bible.
That's the Bible, and that's how I learned.
Right.
That's when I started out.
The
Go-Giver is good, too.
Is about connecting with people.
A little more storytelling than I like. Endless Referrals is a lot more like almost the how-to manual, which I really appreciated when I started.
And I use those techniques in my marketing and my networking.
Yeah.
You know, it's called, I love the whole thing, it's called networking, not net socializing. and, you know, that works out well. But that's how I met you two.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is through networking. Yeah. And
absolutely.
I like networking.
I do too.
You know, it's fun.
Bob Berg is a master. Anyways, we could talk about Bob Berg all day. But the reason I asked you if you were sales trained is they call it bonding and rapport. It's one of the sections of the Sandler training.
Right.
And I'm the same, and I've taught my people in my office to be the same. And it's more than just making a sale. It's truly having the person open up and connect with you on a whole other level. And you mentioned the doctor. I love this analogy because, you know, when you go to the doctor for the first time with this pain that you think you're dying from, and you ask them, so what's wrong with me? The doctor's answer is usually, I don't know. we got to send you off to get like 400 tests and a scan and a whatever. And so I love this analogy because I always tell people we can make a determination of what we're going to do, but it changes. Their strategy happens. We start talking to the other side. Maybe we come to an agreement. Maybe we don't. And it's not as like you pay me and this is what we're going to do. And that's it. And that's a great analogy for us.
And you know, Ellie, that brings brings it down to managing expectations.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think that lawyers have to be really conscious of managing client expectations, because if I turn to a potential client in a criminal defense matter and I say to them, you know, what are you seeking as an outcome? They're going to say, I want the charges dismissed.
of course, make it go away tomorrow.
Right, you know. But, you know, that's not really a good question to ask. Mm-hmm. And so what you really want to do at the end of the day is explain to them, look, these are what we need to, this is what we need to do right now. This is what's going to happen. This is the process you're about to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And as we go through this process, we will learn more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to give me your perspective on how you ended up getting prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
And as we investigate, I'm going to get other perspectives, and then we're going to talk about everything, and we're going to make a determination what's the best path to follow.
Correct.
And as you know, a lot of people don't really understand the role of a criminal defense lawyer. You know, you don't
to get them off, Barry.
Yes,
you have
that's
to
the
get
goal.
Them off,
and I think that's important. You know, it's things like television we talked about, Leslie, right? You know, television portrays criminal matters, criminal trials, as really black and white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, on television, you don't ever see someone standing up in court and accepting a plea agreement.
Exactly.
You know, they're always going to trial. That's
100%.
And so it's black and white.
Yeah.
It's either guilty or not guilty. And even when you go to trial, it's not black and white because you can be found guilty of a lesser charge than what you're charged with. You can be found guilty of some of the charges and not guilty of some of the others. God willing, you're found, from my perspective, not guilty of all the charges. And at the end of the, I keep saying that, God, stop using that phrase.
at the end of the day.
But yeah, at the end of the trial, no. So, you know, you have to manage client expectations.
Yeah.
And in the movies, like I love, I think we were talking about this before we went on the air, you know, you see the Richard Gere character in Chicago.
Yeah.
And he goes into court. And
I was singing the song to on Sunday.
Yeah,
that's
it.
How funny it is that
come
you
on.
Brought this up,
come
because
on,
it's
it.
The razzle dazzle. I love that song. Give them the old razzle dazzle.
Yeah,
razzle dazzle them.
You have such a nice voice.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do.
Beat and feather them. It's such a, and I think of Richard Gere in this instantly.
Doesn't she sing great?
She does.
I'm
she
really
does.
Impressed.
The other song they do in Chicago that's also the other lawyer song is when she's the puppet and basically she's just putting words in her mouth like, where'd you come from? Mississippi. She's just repeating what the lawyer told her and she's a puppet, you know?
But,
yeah,
and
but
I think that's the concept people have of criminal defense lawyers, or maybe lawyers in general, you know, go to court and tap dance.
Yeah. How can they see with sequins in their eyes?
And, you know, I mean, the truth of the matter is that you put in all the time behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, for it's what's the saying? You know, for every hour of court time, you spend 10 hours preparing.
Yeah.
I think it's more
than 10 hours.
Oh,
yeah.
It's amazing how much time we put in. And, you know, during the week when you can, because we all have to run a business. Law now is a business.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been a business, but not like it is now.
Right.
And in addition, you have to deal with all of your cases.
Yeah.
And to find the time to really prepare the way that I like to prepare, it's very demanding.
Yeah.
But when I finally get to court and all the work is done, I love being in the courtroom. I feel alive when I'm in the courtroom. You know, when you're driving in Miami traffic, which is so lovely, it's a lovely drive. When you're driving in Miami traffic, I can see Leslie, man. You must be something in Miami traffic.
Oh, well, that's why I'm never in Miami traffic, because I live down the street.
Oh,
I walk.
Because, Leslie, I have to tell you, I could just see you behind the wheel at 8:45 a.m. in the morning on I-95 or H-26.
Just honking at everyone next
to
me.
Wow.
Honking, because she carries, she said she's a gun person.
She's a gun person. Oh,
I'm going to need your cell phone number, Barry.
It's out there, 786-667-785. Call now.
I've preempted this whole problem by living down the street and not driving to work.
It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, so it's important to me to be realistic with my clients.
Yes.
And I always tell them. Now, I don't tell my clients what to do. I don't say to them, you've got to take this plea agreement. You've got a horrible case and you can't go to trial. That's a huge mistake. And, you know, human nature, as I said, was very complex. You know, I've had people who the evidence against them is very strong.
And they still want to go to trial.
And they still, and 100%. I'm fine with it. Yeah. I'm fine with it because, you know, I did death penalty litigation for many, many years. And usually trying those cases is inevitable because the prosecution's going to offer a plea to life in prison to waive the death penalty.
Uh-huh.
If they even do that, sometimes they won't even do that. So you're trying cases that are really difficult cases, and many times you prevail. Now, prevailing might be a plea to a lesser offense than first-degree murder, or it might be a not guilty, or it might be they get found guilty and the jury recommends life in prison, so you went to trial and you did exactly what would have happened if they pled guilty. But, you know,
But you got your shot.
Well, you got your shot.
Well, but I think the bigger point where you were going, and I think what you were going to say, and I feel very similarly, is you can't tell them what to do. You can only advise as to what you think might be best, but ultimately it's their decision. And to your point, I have lots of clients that we talk about. It's not a plea in our world, but sometimes we'll get an offer of some sort of other relief that we could do that's temporary or not as good, you know, like we'll give you withholding instead of asylum or something like that. Not the same benefits, but still a status or at least keeps you in the country. We get that all the time. And when people ask you, you have to give them a realistic idea. But I definitely have clients who are like, absolutely not. I've been here 15 years and I want to roll the dice.
Right.
And I don't want the lesser thing. It's all or nothing and I'm in, you know. And as long as they understand the risk and, you know, they're usually it's because they're fed up with being in the system and they just want it over and they don't want to live in limbo another 10 years while we wait for hypothetical immigration reform that we've been waiting for 30 years. But it's a similar conversation we get to have. You know?
And, you know, look, I've tried. I lost count.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't keep a scorecard. I've tried well over 100 jury trials in my career, probably more. I don't keep track. But, you know, I've had cases where the evidence is not good. And the results always, many times, I'll go to trial, especially in federal court, and you beat the plea offer at the when the case is done because the judge really gets to see what the case is all about. I've had other cases where I go to trial, and even in the face of overwhelming evidence, and people unfortunately do get found guilty, and they thank me. And they
100%.
Say to me, I just wanted my day in court, especially people who have prior records
100%.
That'll say something like, I am so sick and tired of always pleading guilty. I just wanted to, for once, to fight the case.
I hate to say it, but my proudest referrals that I receive are those that comes from clients whose case we lost. And I say that with pride because we will litigate to the bitter end if that's what they want to do. And that empowers people sometimes.
Yeah.
Like that's important to them. That's they feel like they have taken control and they took the risk and it was on them. And as long as you are truthful and honest and there for the fight, so am I.
Yeah.
And that's all you can ask for sometimes. And you know, I have many clients who I'll give a consult to and we'll tell them you don't qualify for anything. The best thing you can do is do nothing. And we'll get referrals from those people too. Because they don't want to go somewhere and have their money stolen for something that we can't do, you know?
Yeah. And I think that that's what clients want to see.
100%.
I think they want to know you're doing everything you can for them. You're listening to them.
You have their best interest at heart.
Bingo. And you are fighting for them. And if you manage their expectations properly and you're not afraid to call them out when they're being unrealistic or unreasonable, because you have to.
Yeah.
You know, I was representing someone recently, and it was a very minor charge, but to them it was very important. I'm of a belief, you know, people call me all the time and they'll say, you know, I have this misdemeanor case, but it might be too big for you. And I go, wait, hold on. It's not about me. It's about that individual. That individual, that misdemeanor case is the most important thing in their life right
now. Exactly.
So it's important to me. So I had a misdemeanor case that was just a resisting arrest and obstruction of justice mm-hmm. case.
No big deal.
No, it really, you know.
In the scheme of what you do, right.
But to this person,
it was very important.
End of the world, yeah.
And it was on body camera video. And I watched the video, and I watched it several times, and the entire resisting arrest, obstruction of justice, was 1 minute and 16 seconds, where the person was told to get out of their car, did not get out of their car for about 10 seconds maybe.
Okay.
That's all. And was saying, I can't believe you're arresting me. You can't arrest me. And the police officer's like, put your hands behind your back. And the person's going, I, what are you doing? You're arresting me? You're going to handcuff me? But she's putting her hands behind her back. And they handcuff her. And they charge her with resisting arrest for this. And we're in a meeting. And they want me to just destroy this police officer. You know, we're going to trial. I'm not taking pretrial. It was pretrial diversion, okay? Which was fine, but, you know.
Wait, what is pretrial diversion?
Pretrial diversion is a program for first offenders.
What does this mean? I got to go do community service because of this asshole?
Not always. Yeah, but sometimes. But it's a program. It's in Miami, it's very easy because it's usually 6 months or so. And, you know, you stay out of trouble. You might have to make a donation. You might have to do some community service hours. You might have to go to a class, you know, or three classes.
Anger management class.
Or something. And if you complete the program, the charges get dismissed.
Right. So it's your first time offender.
But, you know, and they wanted to go to trial, which I respected. And, you know, I'm sitting here trying to explain and say, look, I know you want me to do all these things, but the officer is never going to say what you think the officer is going to say. I said, your whole case takes place in 1 minute and 19 seconds. And I'm going to focus on those 1 minute and 19 seconds. And you know, the client's arguing with me. And I finally turned to them and said, let me ask you a question. When you go to the doctor, do you tell the doctor how to treat you? And all of a sudden, they stopped and just said, you're right. I hired you to do. And I was so... That changed the whole dynamic because I understood the emotions of it. And believe me, it was very frustrating for me. But the dynamics were such that, you know, you just need to shift the perspective for a second.
Yeah.
And that's like being in tune with where people are coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just argue with someone and expect them to change their mind. You have to just put a different paradigm in place that they can relate to.
100%.
You know? Yeah. So, you know, Ellie, I think that what you do is also so misunderstood.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
I think people have this concept, you know, nowadays about immigrants that somehow they're bad.
Well, I have the politically charged stuff as well.
Yeah, but it's similar to what I do, where people are like, oh, you know, throw away the key. You know, all they know is what they see on TV. You know, lock them up, send them home.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be here. And you just don't think about the majority of people mm-hmm. who are coming to the country to escape oppression and persecution and poverty or just wanting a better life, you know? And it's frustrating.
But similar, what you do, I have a very similar conversation with people when they ask me, you know, like, how do you represent people who've committed crimes? You know, because we do represent people post the criminal part, right? In deportation proceedings when they then try to remove them. And, you know, we have some, very few, but some people who have some serious offenses. And I always have the whole conversation of you have to kind of believe in the justice system and everyone's right to get, you know, the best possible outcome for themselves. And at a fundamental, like that true... maybe idealistic, but that perspective we have when we first go to law school about like everyone deserves this defense. And I do believe that. And I'm sure you believe it even more. I mean, you live in this world with me, but it's the truth, right? It's not about what your client did. It's not about whether that particular person deserves to have the key thrown away or not. It's about the system working and the system being upheld and being tested and being perfected and what that means in our country. That is what justice is in the United States. Exactly. And it's that ideal of you don't get to just throw the key away on anyone without them having a right to defend themselves and present the case if that's what they want to do.
And when it works, it's beautiful. When it's corrupt, you know, it's yeah. not. I mean, you know, Leslie, you're in the civil world, and the civil rules of procedure in Florida just got totally revised and revamped. And the reason is because lawyers were abusing the system, and people couldn't afford to hire attorneys because the cost of litigation were so high.
Sure.
And, yeah. you know, cases took years to move through the courts. And now, you know, they're trying to sort of herd cats, right? I
yeah.
mean, it's mm-hmm. it's difficult what we see, because this, I don't think anyone ever envisioned that the civil courts would be so crowded.
Overrun, yeah.
Overrun.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
And, you know, you couldn't get a trial date for like 3 years, and COVID made it even worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's hard. I think part of what we do is try to make sure that things work the right way. There's nothing I hate more than when I see corruption in the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when, especially when it's people who have spent decades in prison for crimes they didn't commit.
Mm.
And DNA maybe exonerates them now because it wasn't around before.
Right.
But even that's very difficult, right? I've read a little bit on some of those cases.
It is, because I mean, prosecutors try to stop people from getting DNA tested.
Mm-hmm.
And the courts a lot of times don't want to pay for the testing, and
yeah.
the people can't afford. But the reason, but it all really comes back to what usually gets uncovered in those cases is how corrupt the investigation was.
Yeah.
And where they concealed evidence of, you know, that it negated the guilt of the defendant. And they just buried it. It didn't matter to them. Well, we're going to close this case and we're going to pin it on this person. But the murderer is still out there. You know, and it's so,
yeah.
when you see that happens, it's just,
well, it's, I remember, I don't know if in Florida it was true, but I remember, at least in New York for sure, I remember reading an article about the hundreds of thousands of rape kits that were never processed, mm-hmm. and it was like a whole big expose on this, and
right.
how there were years and years of rape kits that just never got processed. Like, they're
right.
just sitting on a shelf still somewhere.
Right, and that's part of, you know, that goes back to the political aspect of it, because law enforcement agencies or,
yeah.
you know, and right now prisons are particularly, you know, they have to have a budget. They have
yeah.
to operate. The Federal
right.
Bureau of Prisons right now is a mess. The Federal Bureau of Prisons is 40% understaffed.
Yeah.
You know, people who work in the prison system who aren't even corrections officers
right.
yeah.
are being asked to be corrections
yes.
officers.
I've heard that. Like the librarian, like the
yeah.
whatever, the person that runs the library, whatever that
right.
is, in the federal prison was asked to start
wow.
know, escorting prisoners to
yeah.
the hospitals and whatever
right.
if they got stabbed or they were hurt or whatever
really?
It was.
I didn't even know that.
That they actually needed
oh,
to
yeah.
go to Larkin or whatever it was. It was
really?
Like,
yeah.
grab whoever you got. Because
yeah.
they're going with the prisoner.
And prisoner, you know, now the programs that are supposed to be offered in prisons to rehabilitate
yeah.
people and to, you know, train them in a vocation
yeah.
or deal with drug addiction or anger management, they're so understaffed that they can't even run the programs.
Right.
And people are being denied the ability to get early release credits so that they can go home sooner. And it's just, it's a real disaster. But, you know, that's a question of where Congress or legislators
yeah.
are going to bring, you know, where are they going
yeah.
to allocate the money? Do you know the number one line item in the budget in the state of Florida is corrections?
Really?
Wow.
I did not know that. Interesting.
Yeah, it's corrections.
Do you have privately funded and privately run correction facilities in Florida?
There were. I don't know if they're
They
anymore.
Do in immigration. That's why I'm asking
Yeah, they're
you.
Awful. It was the GEO
yeah.
group, I
the
think,
GEO.
That ran them.
Yeah.
When you privatize prisons, it's absolutely awful.
I was about to ask your opinion. I know how I feel about it because I still
no.
deal with the GEO group.
They're,
but
they're the worst.
The
they're the worst. They,
yeah.
they're just in it for profit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's the facilities or the food or the staffing, I mean, it's just despicable what those private prisons do to
yep.
people. Yeah, I could go.
Yeah, we deal
things.
We deal with
yeah.
it in immigration
yeah.
world, but I was wondering mm-hmm. if it existed
it did.
In criminal world.
It did.
But it doesn't anymore.
I think it's been phased out because
That's
there
nice.
Were a lot of them.
There were a lot of documentaries on this, I
oh,
feel
yeah.
like.
It's a big battle for us as well in the immigration world, and there's been a lot of documentaries. There was even actually coming out of South Florida, specifically Broward, one of our detention centers that's still very much there in Broward. They did a really interesting expose where we had some journalists who got themselves detained on purpose. Obviously lied about who they were, but they got themselves detained and put in this facility, and they did a whole expose of their experience in the GEO group in Broward. It was fascinating. We shortly thereafter also had a judge retire from the bench on some exposés written about that as
well.
Right
after that expose.
Yeah, there was some really interesting stuff happening, because in our world, you know, the non-privately funded prison, which is in South Florida, at least, is Crome Detention Facility out west, is federally funded, and the Broward one, a Broward Transitional Center, is a private GEO held facility. And interestingly enough, we do have judges, right, that deal with bond and deal with the cases of the people who are detained. And we have extremely strict and harsh judges sitting in the Broward Transitional Center. And we have, I wouldn't say super easy, but fairer judges at the Crome facility. And so when I get hired for something like a bond hearing in immigration court, we actually have a much better shot with our criminal offenders at Crome generally than we do with our non-criminal offenders in the privately held, because that's how they divide the people. If you have any criminal offenses, you go to Crome, to the federally run one. If you have no criminal offenses or very minor things, like, I don't know, traffic offenses or something, you go to Broward Transitional in the private, because they have certain risk levels associated with them, and they only let the private group handle the less risky prisoners. But I can get you bond out of Crome much better than I can get you bond out of BTC, which is absurd. You know. But it makes you wonder, right? Like, how is it that the private facility that I can get nobody out of and that don't have any sort of criminal record, why is it harder to get people out of there? Maybe because the bed's full, and thus they're making money. As long as people are in there,
and that's a factor.
That's a factor.
And, you know, it's very difficult sometimes to explain to an individual defendant that ultimately what's going to happen to you has a lot to do with who your judge is.
100%.
And you know, because there are all types of judges, and for me, all I ask from a judge is be fair, call balls and strikes. That's your job. You know, make a ruling. You know, follow the law and don't interfere if it's a jury trial. Yeah. Don't feel like you have to insert yourself into what the lawyers are doing. I mean, I'm an experienced trial lawyer. I know what I'm allowed to do and not do. You know, I may push the envelope, but all lawyers push the envelope.
That's our job.
And that's our job. But if I've got a legal basis for what I'm doing, if there's an objection, I'll abide by your ruling. I'm not going to stand there and argue with you. I'm just going to keep trying my case. You know, so I think it's kind of frustrating for everyone involved. But there's one thing that I've learned. See, juries, you know, juries have a lot of power.
I know. And I wish I had jury trials. Yeah. I feel like I'd win so much more.
Well, you may, because, you know, you never know what a jury is going to do. I participated in a mock trial training where lawyers put on a case. I was assigned the closing argument, and there was a jury panel that was actually impaneled from Miami-Dade County. They were called it was real jury duty.
Interesting.
And it was presided over by a circuit court judge, Stan Blake, a great judge who just got the Selig Golden. Shout out to Judge Blake.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just got the Selig Golden Lifetime Achievement Award from the Florida Bar this past weekend at the Florida Bar annual meeting. Way to go, Stan. Couldn't happen to a better person.
Yeah.
And the jury then deliberated in the open. So
that is fascinating.
So you can learn from them. Fascinating.
It was, because they looked at things and talked about things. Who would have thought it? So, and you know, one of the things that can happen is if a judge is being unfair to a defendant, juries pick up on it.
Oh.
Like if the prosecutor's objecting and it's getting sustained, and when the defense objects, it's getting overruled. The jury's sort of like, this is not a level playing field.
So I served on a jury I don't know why you would ever put me on a jury, but I was on a jury.
You're so fortunate.
I'm so excited. Yeah. Probably the only excited juror.
She was the only excited juror.
Were you the four person?
I had so much fun. No, there was actually, no, I was not the four person. I did not want to be the four person, but I was not the four person. And we did not get to finalize everything because at the end it was a mistrial.
Oh.
So I was very upset. Wah-wah. But afterwards, one of the parties asked if I interview with them. They wanted to know, like, our impressions. They asked a couple of us, actually, about our impressions, similar kind of, right, to get a... And it was fascinating, because even as an attorney who's looking at the procedure and that part, because you just can't help it when you're sitting there as a lawyer, even I was... There were certain things you were picking up on. There were certain things that bothered me. I had pretty much decided already by the time this ended how I was going to vote.
Right.
And we were 2 days in. I sat there for 2 days before it was declared a mistrial, almost 2 full days. And they still had at least one more day of witnesses. And I had already decided by that point.
So there you go, violating your oath as
I know.
Do not make any decisions until all the evidence is
and
in.
And it's not that you couldn't change my mind if something good happened on day three. But you just can't help but sit there and listen and start forming your opinion, you know?
That, like, shyster lawyer.
I couldn't stand
him. She couldn't stand
him. I couldn't stand him. I was the plaintiff's lawyer. It was a car accident case. And, I mean, this guy couldn't be more like my cousin Vinny if he tried. I mean,
I think that's what he was going for.
I mean, yeah.
He wanted to put on a show for the jury.
He thought this was working in his favor. Meanwhile, she's sitting there with the brace on her neck, and I'm like, this is the fakest thing I've ever seen.
You know, it's so funny you say that. You know, I do watch really good trial movies.
Okay, and my cousin Vinny's one of them?
It's one of the best, most accurate trial movies. Do you know that in trial seminars, they show clips from my cousin Vinny? Because some of those cross-examinations are brilliant. When he's cross-examining the guy, and he looked through his window and said he saw the guys run out of the sack of suds.
Yeah, yeah.
And his investigator, Vinny's investigator, goes and has pictures taken of the guy's trailer. And he's cross-examining him. He starts showing him pictures. And he goes, what is this? And he shows him pictures of my trailer. And he goes, well, what are these things? He goes, windows. He goes, yeah, and what's all this disgusting, greasy stuff
on your window?
On your window. He goes, crud. And what are these things outside of the window? And the guy hesitates, and Vinny looks at him, and the guy goes, bushes? And Vinny goes, that's right, just shout it out, bushes, shout it out. Right? And you know, he shows that the guy couldn't possibly have seen what he saw, or the scene with the lady with the glasses that she can't see.
Can you see it now? Can you see it now?
Like, so, you know, I've used things from my cousin Vinny in my trials. I've done that. I've even said to witnesses when they hesitate to say something, you know, at times I've just put a little humor into it. I go ahead, just shout it out. You know, because there's a place for that in the courtroom.
Yes,
you know, jurors don't want to sit there bored all day. They want to be entertained.
I would actually say that they expect to be, because of television, entertained get annoyed when things aren't as interesting as they thought it would
when
be.
When I say it couldn't be more like my cousin Vinny, I didn't mean in the good way. I meant he was putting on this whole show, and it was just so over the top.
Oh, over the top.
It was so over the top that I wasn't the only one that thought this man was obnoxious, and we were just over this. It felt like it was fake just from how over the top he was being. Like, he was trying so hard. At some point, the judge fell asleep. actually fell asleep.
Snoring?
No, but you saw him, like, do one of these really long blinks that held for a while and then would come. Like, he was actually falling asleep. And then at some point when we were sequestered, one of the other ones, did you see the judge fall asleep? I was like, I did. Did you? Like everyone was talking about how the judge was falling asleep. This is what the jury's talking about during the break, you know?
And,
like,
you don't know
this poor woman can't work anymore. She has vertigo. She has, like, a broken neck.
Listen, she could have had the best case ever, but if there was one lesson I learned from this, it's absolutely matters how you come across in court. It absolutely, your presence is everything.
Who you hire as a lawyer
the
matters.
The tone, who you hire matters. I mean, I had just started. I was actually unemployed, technically. I had just passed the bar when this happened, and I was looking for work. And so, actually, when they asked me, what do you do for a living? I said, well, actually, I just found out I passed the bar, like, 3 weeks ago. So I guess I'm officially an unemployed attorney. That is what I said. That's actually what I said.
And it worked.
And
got on the jury.
And they left her on the jury.
And they left me on the jury. But and then they ask you, you know, or is anyone here going to be paying attention to procedure? Whatever. I've raised my hand. I'm like, me, for sure. I mean, I can't sit here and not.
You know, if you had gotten to deliberations, you so would have been the fourth.
I know. But I didn't want to be. I didn't want to be. I was very adamant that I didn't want to be. And there was one guy that was really outspoken, so I think I would have let him have it.
You know, I got to tell you, that's one place, and I learned this in when I was an intern in the public defender's office. You know, my background in film really helped me and helps me 100%. As a trial lawyer.
Yeah.
Because I'm a storyteller.
Absolutely.
I tell stories.
You took the words out of my mouth. It's all about storytelling.
I tell stories, and you know, a lot of times in a trial, things don't happen chronologically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a witness might talk about one thing that happened on this date, another one on another date, and depending. And it's not just how you're doing it in the courtroom in your cross examinations or your direct examinations. You know, your opening statement, you have to tell a story that brings them in. And when you do your closing statement, you know, a lot of people don't realize when a film gets shot, it doesn't get shot in order.
Mm-hmm.
Films get shot out of order.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the process, it gets given to a film editor, and many times in conjunction with the director and sometimes the producer, it gets edited. Mm-hmm. And depending on who your editor is, you can get two different films. So when you do your closing argument, you're the film editor,
mm-hmm.
and you're putting the story together. And it's really served me so well in the courtroom.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, so I
actually teach at a trial skills college every mm-hmm. year as well for immigration specifically. And most of it is about that. It's not at all about the law, and it's all about trial skills. And it's all about how you build the story, mm-hmm. who's the hero of your story, you know, who's the victim, who's the persecutor, and really building out a storyline. And for us, it's bench trials. So how to break that mold of this judge has heard the same case
but
over and over.
But the judge doesn't
want
to
over.
Fall asleep.
They
no,
don't.
You just
and so,
said that.
Exactly. But... And having a theme and sticking to your theme and the use right. of triads and the use of, like, it's all about storytelling. And that is ultimately what we do in a courtroom.
Absolutely.
I couldn't agree with you more. The rest of it is.
And, you know, I still go to seminars
regularly.
Absolutely. Because you never stop learning in this field. You never stop learning in life.
Everything. You how know? To do a direct, how to do a cross. It's all about the story that you're telling in that particular moment. 100%. I couldn't agree with you more.
And, you know when you've got them. You know, you really know when you've got them. You know, there's nothing mm-hmm. worse than looking at a jury and no one will make eye contact with you.
Yeah.
You know, that's horrible.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a great career.
It is.
If you've got the stamina for it, if you can do it, because it drains the hell out of you.
It
it's
does.
Very draining.
It takes a lot of energy.
But I love it. I absolutely love it. It's what I do.
I love it too. Although the business of law is very different from the practice of law, I'd say.
Yeah, it would be really great if I could just hire someone to run the business. That would be great. That
I
so
enjoy
happy.
The business of law. I do. I really enjoy it now. But I will tell you that it's trial work especially is still very rewarding to me. Mm-hmm. It does take it out of you. But occasionally you get that nice burst and you remember exactly
question.
Why you got into this.
Yeah,
and
no question.
It's rewarding.
About it.
Yeah, it's rewarding.
Yeah.
So.
And I love when, you know, a client is so grateful mm-hmm. for what we do
mm-hmm.
and they express it. I just had a really nice conclusion to a case just about 2 weeks ago, and it had been an investigation that was going on for about 3 years, and an indictment was issued and my client was not part of it, and that
nice.
Was huge. It was just really huge for them, and they just were so profusely mm-hmm. thankful and grateful and wrote this wonderful review online for me. I was like,
that's really nice.
I was like reading it and I'm like, oh my God, I had to, you know, just call and say, I can't believe you, but thank you so much. And reviews are like nowadays, for better or worse, are so important.
Yeah.
You know, in the business of law,
because
mm-hmm. So many people are wanting to look and see what's there. And it was just one of those moments that's like, this is why I do what I do.
Yeah, it has its moments. We have a client who brings us Christmas gifts every year. And her case has been over for like 4 years. And every year she comes once a year. She comes with some sort of food for the whole office. And actually brings a gift. No, she brings a gift. And she always shows up every year, even though we haven't spoken to her because she's no longer a client. She's been granted. Everything is good. And she comes every year just to say thank you again. And she remembers us. And we remember her as a result. But
nice.
But it is rewarding stuff. It's life-changing, right? What we do is truly life-changing, which,
So I want to know... from Leslie.
Yeah.
And then from you.
Okay.
Since we've covered so much. When it comes to the pantheon of movies,
ooh,
not TV shows, movies about law.
Ooh.
You know, like that have a legal basis. Even if they're not, even if they're like, you know, more about people than law. But do you have like a favorite movie that's like in the legal genre?
You know, I'm not sure I do, and I don't get to the movies very often either.
Yeah, but everything's
but I see
on
a
Netflix
lot of, that's
now.
True. I'm like, I see a lot of documentaries on Netflix.
Yeah,
yeah, that's so. No, I mean, if you gave me a list, maybe I'd be able to.
Well, by the way, so you know, documentaries and movies together on Netflix now is a really good one called "Remembering Gene Wilder."
Mm. Which
oh,
is I saw
so
that.
Unbelievable.
I mean, I saw it pop
up.
Yeah,
it's
up,
great.
But I did not...
It's his whole body of work. And
yeah.
It's just, so you're on Netflix.
Well, yes, yeah. Know? But I'm usually there watching criminal documentaries, you see. Like that's literally what
right.
I'm doing. Or some type of corruption thing or another. Or
yeah, what's the one about that's out you know. There now? I only know because my wife watches all of these things.
Yeah.
So, and I when I you know come in and she's watching them and you know I'm like looking at them. There was one recently about a woman who faked her own kidnapping. And then ended up getting exposed, and you know,
I don't know which one this
everything
one
collapsed around her. You know,
interesting.
Yeah, but that's something.
Is this the one at the LQM?
No,
the girl,
no,
the...
that was the girl that killed her parents with the boyfriend.
Oh,
that's another
God,
one.
Yes,
there's so many
else.
Of these.
Yeah.
I'm not
allegedly,
a big documentary.
She hasn't been convicted. Allegedly killed her parents.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay,
you know, and we lose sight
allegedly.
Of the presumption of innocence, especially at the beginning phases when your client's just accused of something and the judge treats them like they actually did.
Right,
so,
right.
What about you?
So in the comedy, it has to be My Cousin Vinny. So I gave that one away. But but if I were going the other way, I think it is a tie.
Ooh,
I think it's a tie between To Kill a Mockingbird, which is excellent, and The Devil's Advocate.
Wow, you know The Devil's Advocate. There's a scene in The Devil's Advocate. That I have never forgotten, and To Kill a Mockingbird is just brilliant.
Yes, it's brilliant.
But there's a scene in The Devil's.
It's hard
Advocate.
To even put those two in the same sentence.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
yeah.
But there's a reason. There is a scene, and I'm wondering if it's the same one. So I'm going to let
scene
you keep
on
going.
The subway.
Okay.
Where these two thugs, try to accost Keanu Reeves and Al Pacino, and Al Pacino looks at one of the guys and he says, "Hey, Carlos. You know, your wife, Angela, is fucking your neighbor, Pablo, right now. You might want to go home." And the guy looks at him because he told him the names of everyone.
Yeah.
And they, like, bolt out of that thing. And you just know the mayhem that is
that's
going
gonna
to
happen.
Ensue. That scene is the...
That's the one that stuck with you. Interesting.
Is that what...
No. The scene... The reason I like The Devil's Advocate... Well, I mean, there's a lot of good scenes in The Devil's Advocate, frankly. There's so many good lawyer quotes, too, in The Devil's Advocate. But the scene I like, and it's not necessarily a good scene, but the scene I like is when he's prepping the witness for trial, and the secretary, who says that she was screwing her boss... And he asks her, "Is he circumcised?" And she takes a moment and she freezes, like she doesn't know the answer. And it's kind of the first time he realizes they're lying, right? And he goes on anyways, and we could talk about that all day. But I loved it because I use this technique a lot when I'm doing direct and cross, where I'll ask a question that's very unexpected for shock value is the wrong way to put it, but to like break the pattern of whatever's going on. And I just thought it was a brilliant question to ask, and it always stuck with me, that moment of if you're gonna when you catch someone on guard, you get that truthful reaction. In his case, it wasn't a truthful reaction, it wasn't a good reaction, but nevertheless he got the truth out of her without her ever saying a word, just by asking this question. But it stuck with me as how powerful our job is, right? Like how much power we can wield with a question, and just watching
it's
the
true.
reaction,
you know.
And I love that scene. I've never forgotten it.
You know, it's interesting. I was trying a case several years ago, and the police officer had pulled this car over because it had dark windows and he couldn't see inside the car, and it was coming out of a trailer park, and he suspected that they had engaged in some sort of drug transaction. And I got into the case after the motion to suppress the evidence for a bad stop of the vehicle was denied by a judge. And we go to trial. And, you know, the client, he wanted to go to trial. He was one of those people who's like, I'm not rolling over and I'm not taking this plea. And we go to trial, and the police officer testified, well, I pulled this car over because it had dark tinted windows and I couldn't see inside. And the prosecutor said, well, why is that important? He goes, well, we didn't know how many people were inside the car. And then the prosecutor goes, well, why did you need to know how many people were in the car? Well, we needed to know if they were dangerous when we pulled them over. We needed to know if it was a man or a woman, and we needed to know what race they were.
Oh, God.
That was his direct testimony.
Wow.
So I get up, and I cross-examine him. I said, he just gave me gold.
Wow.
Yeah, he did.
I get up, and I cross-examine him, and I go slowly through everything. So you pulled over the car because it had dark tints. And you pulled over the car because you couldn't see inside. And you were concerned about your if it was dangerous. And you didn't know if it was a man or a woman, and you didn't know how many people. And he's like, yes, yes, yes. And I go, and you didn't know if they were black. And he goes, that's correct. And I go, and I just turn to the jury and I look at the jury.
I mean, is the prosecutor about to die now?
Yeah. They don't know what's coming.
Oh, shit.
And I just turn and I look at the jury, not the witness. And I go, so tell me, officer, what difference does it make if they're black?
Yeah.
And that jury was just shaking their head, like, and found the guy not guilty.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
awesome.
Because it was just, it wasn't, it just came down. It was just one of those things.
It's
so,
one of those things.
So my favorite movie.
I was about to ask you back. You must tell us now that you asked.
Ask me.
So what is your favorite? What is, there's so many good ones, because I'm sitting here still reeling with like other ideas of answers. But
well,
now I'm going
to
say, I'm going to stick
Leslie
to mine.
Ask me.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm just dancing.
What is your favorite movie?
No, favorite legal movie.
Favorite legal movie.
He's going to say something like 12 Angry Men or something.
No, that's a great one. That's a great one. My favorite movie is Cinema Paradiso. That's my favorite all-time movie. But my favorite legal movie is from the 1930s. And it's Witness for the Prosecution with Charles Laughton, playing an English barrister, and it's a murder case, and it's just so great. And there's this great scene on it where the witness comes in to testify, and it's the wife, and she comes in to testify, and she gives her direct examination, and then the judges turn to Charles Laughton. He's this great classic English actor, and they go cross examination. He goes, no questions. And the judges look at him and go, no questions? He goes, that's right. No questions. In fact, I'm surprised that when she laid her hand upon the Bible, it didn't burst into flames. And to this day, I love that movie. And I love
that's
that
a great line.
And I'm not very ashamed dramatic. To say that I have used that line.
Have you really?
No.
Without the English accent.
Oh, wow.
And since we don't swear on Bibles anymore in the court, I just say it's a good thing we don't swear. I'll actually sit in the witness chair, and I'll talk to the jury, talk about theater, and I'll show how they were lying, you know, being much less than truthful. And I'll say, and it's a good thing we don't swear on Bibles anymore, because I guarantee you, if they had put their hand on a Bible, it would have burst into flame. And it always gets a rise out of the jury.
I'm sure.
Always.
Wow. Yeah. So that is very theatrical, but I love that. I love that. That's interesting. Yeah. Now I got to go watch this movie.
Oh, yeah. You can probably find it somewhere, but it's from the 30s. It's, you know, one of the greats.
Interesting.
But there are so many.
There are so many good ones. There are, and if we start talking crime movies, there's so many good ones too. Because then I was thinking, does that count as legal drama? No, legal drama is like courtroom drama. Is what I picture.
Like Kramer versus Kramer. Right. Is it really a courtroom movie, but it's a legal movie?
Yeah, I guess that's true. Well, there's also Double Jeopardy. You remember Double Jeopardy?
Fred McMurray.
That's a great movie.
Barbara Stanwyck. I think.
Not really a court movie either, but still.
No, but still.
Still interesting legal issues there. Have you seen Double Jeopardy? No.
Yeah.
Leslie's lost in space with this conversation.
You know, it's like, you know, it's funny because when I was growing up, I was watching movies that were from the 30s and the 40s, and that was in the 60s and the 70s, so it was like they were like 40 years old. And last night, I walked in the room, and my wife was watching a movie with Meryl Streep and Robert De Niro called Falling in Love. And it was from 1984. That was 40 years ago.
Wow, man. Don't
and
say
so,
that.
Oh, my God, Barry.
No, but it's so crazy because, you know, the difference in time. So at least it's in color. You know, I was watching black and white movies. You know, so it was.
He just made us feel real old.
Come on, don't get me started. I was talking with my son about Star Wars the other day, and you know, Star Wars was my freshman year in college in 1977. Oh, wow. It came out, so you know.
Does Judge Dredd count as a legal movie?
No.
I am the law. I feel like that counts too. Come on. Yeah. I am the law. You don't know what I'm talking about? It's like the classic Stallone.
It's great.
You know? All right. Anyways, on that note, any final closing words for our listeners and viewers, Barry?
My final closing words are, this has been a lot of fun.
It has been fun.
I have really enjoyed it. You know, I just want to say that when you have an issue, when you have a criminal problem, okay, and you have all that anxiety and, you know, concern and embarrassment, it's normal and it's expected. And don't let it really make you feel powerless and like you can't do something. What you really need to do, and we are blessed in South Florida with one of the finest criminal defense bars in the United States.
Yeah.
Go consult with a criminal defense lawyer.
Yeah.
And, you know, you may not like what they have to say, or you may love what they have to say, but you need to really talk to someone who can walk you through it. It's like, you know, we said, Leslie, you know, when you have that pain in your side, Dr. Google gets you all freaked out.
Yeah,
you know, you're freaked out because you have so much uncertainty. And if nothing else, a good criminal defense lawyer can give you some real perspective and idea about what you can expect in your case, and take advantage of that.
Should empower you at least have the knowledge and understanding.
And the majority of criminal defense attorneys will give you a consultation without charge. There are some who want to be compensated for a consultation, and at times I want to be compensated. But, you know, at most of the time, you can get an hour of a criminal defense attorney's time. And if you've got a serious case, don't feel like you have to stop at one lawyer.
Right.
You're going to put your future in this person's hands. And you got to make sure that that's the person you want.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's not just about you. It's about you, your family, and your job, and everything that goes with the possible stigma of having a criminal record, and you want to do everything you can to either eliminate that or minimize it. And that's the thought I will leave you with.
I like that thought. Those are excellent closing words, Barry. Thank you so much for coming today, and thank you all for watching and listening. We'll see you again next week on Law Shit You Should Know.